Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Daniel Brooke about his new book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. Daniel Brooke is one of the most interesting writers in New Orleans. His journalism might pop up in Harper's Magazine, The Nation, or the New York Times Magazine, and his book titles are always provocative. He's the author of A History of Future Cities, The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction, and The Trap, Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner Take All America. But I think most readers will have a very hard time resisting his newest, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. Welcome back to The Reading Life, Daniel. It's a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me back.
The Einstein of Sex is one of those books that rescues someone lost to history, and what a history it is. So tell us about discovering this life, which has such rich implications for today.
Well, it's really amazing that Magnus Hirschfeld went missing. During his life, he was world famous. In the U.S., he was known as the Einstein of Sex. His obituary actually appears in major media twice. In the early 1920s, he is attacked by fascist thugs on the streets of Munich, and all the world's papers print these obits, and then he recovers, and for the rest of his life tells the funny story of reading his own obituary. But he's really disappeared, unfortunately, really in the 1950s, after he dies after the war. Like, it would be convenient to kind of blame his arch enemies, the Nazis, for disappearing him. They physically disappear him. They chase him out of the country. But he's their perfect foil. He's a German-Jewish doctor who specializes in sexuality. He does, in his clinic and museum, the Institute for Sexual Science in the middle of Berlin, he does some of the world's first gender-affirming surgeries. He's providing psychotherapy to queer and trans individuals. He has this museum of sexuality that sort of brings the whole wide world of sex into the middle of Berlin. And then till the very end of his life is, as I said, you know, the kind of the man the Nazis love to hate. They can't stop talking about him. It's really Americans in the 1950s who can't talk about anything queer. And it should be said, you know, the Soviet Union, the other victor of the war, also in the 1950s, goes into a kind of anti-queer panic, which contrasts again with its earlier history. And that's where he goes missing. I stumbled across him the first time I was in Berlin in the Jewish Museum. I had never heard of him, but he seemed like a fascinating figure. And then I kind of came back to him sort of circuitously through the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, which had a plaque on the wall that mentioned that the word racism didn't exist in the 1800s, which was something,
wow.
which was something I you know, intuitively knew, but never really thought about, in that I had just finished The Accident of Color, a book about Reconstruction, a book about what we would call racism in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. I'd read countless newspaper articles from that period, magazine articles, and then, you know, come to think of it, you don't have the word racism in them. You have white supremacy, bigotry, prejudice, never racism. So then I looked at where the word racism comes from. First book in the English language called Racism is by Magnus Hirschfeld. Have I heard of this guy? I Google him and I find out, yes, it is this guy I encountered in the Jewish Museum in Berlin, but he's much more famous for coining the word transvestite in 1910 when he does the first study, the first sympathetic study of trans people. I was like, whoa, the same mind kind of came up with these two concepts. I need to know this guy. And why don't I?
I know. And the light bulb goes on. I mean,
down the rabbit hole.
You know, his dates were 1868 to 1935, but he was such a man ahead of his time.
Yeah, he's putting out a gay rights pamphlet in 1896. As I mentioned, he's writing a sympathetic study of what we would now call trans individuals. Of course, he uses the word transvestite in German, which is transvestit, in 1910. And then he you know, with his dying breath, he's trying to warn the world about what he calls the poison gas of racism. This is a chilling turn of phrase. And he meant it purely as a metaphor, I should say. His idea is that, you know, the worst thing he could conceive of is that there would be some kind of forced sterilization program. He doesn't think it would go so far as a mass murder program.
And he developed his own theories of sexual relativity and came up with ways to test for them.
Yeah, so he has this idea that he keeps kind of applying more broadly. He starts with gay rights. He himself is a gay man. He's quiet. He's sort of quiet about it, but not closeted. You know, his certainly his friends know. It's sort of an open secret. But he tries to write as an objective scientist about, you know, quote unquote, the homosexuals. But he's living his life as a gay man. And even in his first gay rights pamphlet, he's already realizing that everyone's sexuality is different, that everyone has different degrees of attraction to the same sex and the opposite sex, that, you know, what we now call bisexuality is probably very widespread, and that ultimately everyone is unique in their sexuality. So he comes up with this kind of scientific formula where everyone gets these like A5 plus B2 rankings about their kind of same sex and opposite sex attraction. But then he even within that, he realizes that no one sexually is exactly alike. He writes, quote, "Let us consider the endless variety of tastes according to which one likes blondes, the other dark hair, that one the strong, this one the delicate, that one the smooth, others the hairy, this one a petite foot, another a soulful eye, this one the uniformed, that one a naked person." And then this idea that we're all essentially, you know, whereas people are like snowflakes, everyone's unique. He then applies to gender identity, that we're all some mix of masculinity and femininity, and then ultimately to race. He makes the argument that basically the only people we truly share a race with are our siblings. I mean, our race is nothing but a record of all the reproductive sex that our ancestors have had going back forever, including, you know, the sex no one wanted to acknowledge or talk about, wanted to pretend didn't happen.
Well, he seemed to take all these things, all this information, with great equanimity. Gender nonconformity was far more common than most people thought.
I mean, I think he, you know, he's both a scientist and an activist. And he's actually, I think, crucially, this is often ignored even in, you know, even in works about him, you know, as this figure for whom I think deserves a lot more work. He begins as a journalist. He gets a medical degree, and then he, just like his father was a doctor and his big brother's a doctor, and it's the family tradition that he's kind of forced into. He's much more interested in the world. And one of his brothers moved to Chicago as an immigrant, and he goes to Chicago as a foreign correspondent for German newspapers. And I think that experience as a journalist makes him aware of the importance of being able to speak to quote-unquote civilians, being able to speak to people who don't have medical degrees or who maybe, you know, don't have these highfalutin advanced academic degrees, but are, in a democracy, are citizens and need to be reached and can be swayed by arguments if they're pitched to them properly. And he's always looking for new media to do this. He does pamphlets. He does a really dishy, gossipy, but kind of with a heart of gold book called Berlin's Third Sex, which is about queer life in Berlin in the early 1900s. He makes a queer rights, gay rights movie in 1919, a silent film called Different from the Others. And he's always pitching the masses. I mean, one of his early arguments is the what I call the Born This Way hypothesis, yeah, with all due credit to Lady Gaga, which is the argument we're familiar with, which is that, you know, people are born gay, they don't become gay. This is he's fighting with Freud, who's kind of his frenemy. Freud's idea is that, you know, some early childhood trauma makes people turns people gay, and Hirschfeld is arguing no, you know, people are born this way. And I mean, it has numerous virtues. One is, you know, scientifically, I think he thinks it's the most likely explanation for homosexuality. I think it resonates with his own experience, which is he had this like very happy bourgeois childhood and was gay. And it's like, well, you know, the nanny didn't drop me on my head and my father didn't tell me terrible things, or my mother wasn't cold to me. All of the kind of Freudian explanations didn't make sense in his experience. But I also think he understood how politically savvy this was. That it's like, if you're born this way, what is the point? There's no cure. Makes persecution both cruel and nonsensical.
Well, he seemed to counsel his patients towards self-acceptance in such a gentle and effective way. And he offered assistance to those who wished to transition. He traveled the world, mapped many of the cities we now regard as gay meccas. Although I do wonder what he thinks of New Orleans.
I do wonder that too. I should say one of my favorite little physical artifacts that still exists is a prescription form from the Institute for Sexual Science that the head of the trans therapy unit, whose name was Dr. Felix Abraham, gave to one of his patients. And it's written on a medical prescription form, but it's three things. It's one person. It's like, you need to meet, I believe his name's Karl Riggers. He's the head of the Trans Club of Berlin. And then there are two bars listed. Two and three are bars. These are trans-friendly bars. You need to meet this guy and go to these two bars, and then you'll be like in a much better place
as a
trans Berliner. Yeah. So as you can see, I call Hirschfeld the intellectual impresario of Weimar Berlin. He's kind of the intellectual linchpin behind everything we know in its own version from Cabaret, which is this kind of gender mishmash, cosmopolitan, multilingual, everything thrown together, all in this inspiring and kind of harrowing cauldron of 1920s Germany. And I think there are very clear echoes in New Orleans, both positive and negative, of this kind of this joy amidst chaos, and a place that is on this kind of nice edge of like radical acceptance and radical prejudice. And I think that that's, for better or for worse, a much larger story than New Orleans. That's sort of the precipice that we're on.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Daniel Brook about his new book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin.
One of the things that enchanted me was the way you described him as someone who could explain Berlin to Berliners. And he set about doing the series of books that would do just that.
Yeah, he participates in something called Metropolis Documents, which is a series of these, one scholar today calls them pointillist portraits of Berlin, where each one focuses on kind of a different subculture. There were dozens of these books, and Hirschfeld is assigned the queer subculture and writes this book, Berlin's Third Sex. But there are others, and sort of taken together, you have this portrait of the metropolis, where part of living in a multiplicitous, modern, chaotic city is there are so many subcultures and demimondes that one person can't really experience them all. One of the wonders of New Orleans is that you do have access to more than you do most places. On Mardi Gras day, from my front stoop, I can be at the Zulu parade. I can be at the queer costume contest later in the day. I can be at the Bohemian St. Anne's parade. Everything kind of comes together, but there's only one you, and you can't be everywhere. And to try to fully understand a great city, you do need these multiple perspectives. And that's what I think he's giving. I should say that I consider the city of Berlin one of the main characters of the book.
Oh, absolutely. But I can see you with your love of cities coming across this series of books and going, ah!
It's such a brilliant move of like, how do you understand a city in all of its complexity? And it's this editor who comes up with it. His name's Oswald, and then taps Hirschfeld and taps other people. He taps people who know the music, the gig musicians world. He taps someone who knows the theater world, someone who knows the coffee house world. The lesbian world actually doesn't come out because of censorship fears. That's probably the only one that might have outsold even Hirschfeld's Berlin's Third Sex.
Well, let's talk a bit about what this book has to offer the present moment, because there's so much here.
Hirschfeld is celebrating human diversity and really making an argument that I think we need now, and that I think is being opposed now and even suppressed now, which is that, we are all one human family, that any hard and fast distinction between people is arbitrary and often ginned up to serve the political power of the people doing the ginning up. Hirschfeld's whole philosophy is that we're all mixed up, we're all unique individuals, and that the democratic experiment of Weimar Berlin, of Germany between the wars, of this country for 250 years, but most pointedly, really since the civil rights movement revolution of the 1960s, is trying to create a democratic society we can all participate in equally. Mm-hmm. And there are those who see that as a barrier to their power, and they want to divide people, and you see it in real time right now.
And you see book burning.
You see
always a sign,
yep, You see the banning of books. And in the Hirschfeld world, you see in the democratic period, people will argue with him, But the real extremists try to intimidate him. They send him death threats. As I said, in the, you know, the 1920s, when Germany's ostensibly a free and democratic society, there are paramilitary goons beating him up. And there's an effort, ultimately, you know, once these paramilitary goons on the streets of Munich take over the country, they burn his books. The famous Nazi book burning in Berlin, you know, with the newsreel footage that we can all kind of play in our mind's eye, that was literally Hirschfeld's books. Literally in the sense that they were burning books like The Transvestites and Berlin's Third Sex that he published, but also that the trove of books they were burning was the library of the Institute for Sexual Science. It was the archive of Hirschfeld's clinic and museum and research center in the middle of Berlin that they had raided a few days before.
Are there any other figures like this that we don't know about yet?
There's always right there, and now I'm going to sound like Donald Rumsfeld right there, the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. surely there are, of course, there are actually kind of two kinds of biographers, right? There are the biographers who want to tell you something new about the person you already know, and then the kind of biographer who wants to find someone you haven't heard of and tell you why you need to hear about them. And I'm kind of the latter, and I am confident there are plenty more. The other thing that's interesting, and this is something we kind of know, but often forget, is like the people who are famous in their own time sometimes disappear out of history and vice versa. You know, you always hear about Mozart has his funeral and nobody even shows up and he's buried in an unmarked grave because no one thinks he's worthy of being remembered. And now, you know, you can go to any city in the world and hear his music being played.
Do you feel that he was free? Do you think he felt free?
That's a very perceptive question. That's why I love this show. Without naming names, I'm just going to say that not every radio host who does book talks really engages with all of the books before they go on the air. Do I think he felt free? I think man is born free, but everywhere in chains. I think he felt free-ish and he wanted to feel freer. And that's sort of how liberalism is, right? It's not a utopian philosophy, but it's, or even psychotherapy is not utopian, but there's the idea that we can get from a worse place to a better place. And I think his important insight over the course of his life is that that has to be a private struggle, but also a public struggle. Because initially he begins as this medical doctor who's providing anonymous psychotherapy to queer patients. And then when one of those patients commits suicide and sends him a suicide note that says, you know, we need to change this society or there's no hope. That's when he first puts out this pamphlet, this public pamphlet, and he writes it under a pseudonym. He takes this very cautious step out where he puts out a pamphlet under a pseudonym, and then a few years later, he puts his name on it in the second edition. He stops being this anonymous, this pseudonymous, mysterious Berlin physician and becomes, you know, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld.
Because he saw so much of the world. I can just picture him in Carl Van Vechten's living room. You know what I mean?
That's part of why, I mean, I love travel, and that's part of why I was drawn to him. I mean, he's traveling as much as he can his whole life. He threatens when he's 10 years old, he's going to leave home and walk to Paris. That's what he says. And then 3 days later, he comes home because he's hungry and realizes this is not a great idea. But as I said, he goes to America as a young man right after getting his medical degree, rather than becoming this German doctor that he's kind of fated to become by his family. He goes immediately to America. He takes a very circuitous route home through North Africa, which is sort of a mind-blowing experience in that it has very different ideas about sexuality, including gay male sexuality, than the Northern European scene that he comes from. And he's sort of in the hammams and the souks and taking all of that in. And then he returns home through Italy, which is actually legally a much more comfortable place to be gay in that it's not criminalized, whereas it is at that period in Germany. And then ultimately, in his attempt to kind of get away from Germany just till this whole fascism thing blows over, he comes back to America and then he keeps extending the trip because fascism doesn't blow over. The fascists keep getting more power and it becomes clear that he can't go home. So he moves from Germany to France, which if you look at a map, two countries that border each other via the entire world. He goes through the US from the East Coast to the Midwest to the West to Hawaii, then to Japan and Southeast Asia and India and the Middle East, in Greece, and he ends up publishing a book called World Journey of a Sex Researcher about his travels. So he'd been, you know, he'd been running, editing this journal that he created, a journal called the Journal of Sexual Intermediaries, with special emphasis on homosexuality. It's this very German scientific, long-named journal. And he'd been publishing research about gender and sexuality globally in this scientific journal. And then now he's finally able to see it. So he goes like up to the Himalayas and sees what a matriarchal society looks like. He goes to the market at Darjeeling, which is near the India-China border. And he sees these polyandrous women. There's like a matriarch with five husbands, and the husbands are doing all the scut work, carrying all the goods to market. And the matriarch is presiding leisurely, you know, smoking her pipe. So, you know, he's heard about, oh, there are these matriarchal societies, but hasn't witnessed them. Then he's, you know, he's heard about trans communities in Indonesia and India, but then he's with them, you know, with a translator talking to them. His last night in Bombay on New Year's Eve, you know, he's staying in the Taj Mahal Hotel. He's always in kind of posh surroundings, but always seeking out the kind of red light districts, the seedier parts of cities. And on New Year's Eve, he spends it in this working class trans sex worker district rather than, you know, with all the posh people in the lobby of his hotel.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Daniel Brook about his new book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin.
The thing is, our erotic lives are so fragile, and it takes such energy and courage to put it out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, this made it into the introduction, but I gave my father, my 80-something father, a look at the intro that I was planning to write, and he came back with the, you know, you need to kind of explain that, like, Einstein's theories, whatever. He's like, I'm not a scientist. I don't even understand Einstein's theories. Einstein's talking about physics and how time works. And, like, ultimately, like, it's brilliant, but who cares? Hirschfeld is writing about sex. He's writing about something that people think about all the time. You know, it's something we that's sort of ever present and rarely talked about. And he's putting it front and center.
So, and besides this book, you're doing something a little unusual for the book launch. Tell us about that.
Yes. So I've been studying German to help me, which is very difficult.
Better late than never.
Yeah, that's true. With a teacher who's from Germany, but in true New Orleans fashion, is really here because she's a very talented jazz clarinetist, Susanna Ortner. And we and some of her musical compatriots are going to do a book launch cabaret at the Always Lounge. The Always Lounge, you know, sort of where the spirit of Weimar Berlin lives in New Orleans. And that's going to be on Monday night, May the 12th, doors at 7. There's going to be snacks. There's going to be a cash bar. I'm going to even sing. And there'll be a slideshow, 21 plus. It's going to be a really wonderful evening. And the Always Lounge, again, this is a kind of thing where things get lost, has a very clear analog in Weimar Berlin. So the Always Lounge, as its patrons know, some people in New Orleans know, it's spelled A-L-L-W-A-Y-S, Always Lounge. And they have a sign that, you know, everyone's welcome, you know, all gender presentations, sexual orientations, race, religion, etc. There was a bar until the Nazis shut it down called Alles eine Familie, which means all one family in Weimar Berlin, which had the same outlook.
Well, that's perfect then. Well, we've been talking with Daniel Brook, whose new book is The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. Daniel, congratulations. It's an amazing, amazing book.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you, as always.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Morgan Jerkins signs her new novel, Zeal, Friday, May 9th from 4 to 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Naomi DeBerry presents a story time, My Daddy Needs a Gift, Saturday, May 10th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. Two local authors, David Armand and C.W. Cannon, will be the featured speakers at the Saturday Writers Clinic for May 10th. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Armand discusses realistic dialogue versus perfect dialogue at 9:30, followed by Cannon discussing creative nonfiction at 11 a.m. Free of charge, open to the public. Sarah Guillory reads from and signs her books, Gus and Glory, and Nowhere Better Than Here, Monday, May 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Four local romance paranormal writers Don Chartier, author of The Fallen Guardian, Elise Arden, author of The Casket Girls, Gillian Zane, author of Nola's Zombie Series, and D.M. Bourgeois, author of Edge of Reality. Discuss their work Monday, May 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Free of charge, open to the public. Registration is not required. Jerry Craft and Kwame Alexander signed their new children's book, J vs. K, Monday, May 12th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Daniel Brook presents a book launch cabaret for his new book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. That's Monday, May 12th at 7 at the Always Lounge, Twilight Room. Enter on Marigny Street. Live music by Suzanne Ortner, David Simons, and Harry Mayron. No cover, but venue is for 21 and older. S.C. Perot discusses and signs Styles of Joy, Tuesday, May 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop in a ticketed event. Douglas Jones signs his new novel, The Fantasies of Future Things, Tuesday, May 13th at 6 at Baldwin & Company in a ticketed event. There will be an evening of books and burlesque with Alice Murphy, Jess Armstrong, and Betsy Propane. That's celebrating the publication of Alice Murphy's book, A Showgirl's Rules for Falling in Love, Thursday, May 15th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Kennedy Ryan discusses and signs Can't Get Enough, Thursday, May 15th at 6 at Baldwin & Company.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.